Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Hello, this is Kristen Johnston-Largent from the Gettysburg Seminary podcast, the Seminary Explorers, and I'm very delighted today to welcome as our guest Dr. Tim Shannon, Professor of History at Gettysburg College and Chair of the History Department. Welcome, Tim.
Hi, Kristen. Thanks for having me.
Well, Tim, as you and I have been talking, and we've been thinking about the July 4th, we always have a kind of some special podcasts around July 4th, and when I was looking on the website and looking at your areas of interest, noting that you do early American history, but particularly looking at Native American and European encounters during that time. And I think that that's something that often doesn't get talked about or thought about, particularly in conjunction with Independence Day, right? I mean,
right.
Sometimes on a very different kind of level or area, we can talk about that. But I thought it might be interesting to, as we anticipate those celebrations, what was happening in those encounters at that time?
Sure. You know, when we talk about the 4th of July, we usually think about the Founding Fathers, and we think about the Declaration of Independence, most obviously, but also, you know, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, George Washington, and
right.
I think most, you know, one of the things I think history education does well in America is students from a very early age do learn about the Battle of Saratoga, they learn about the Battle of Yorktown and the shot heard around the world and that sort of thing. I think historians of this era, and within the last generation or so, have been turning their attention westward, almost on a continental scale to talk about what's going on in North America, not just between redcoats and continental soldiers during the period of the Revolution, but how the American Revolution is affecting relations between indigenous peoples, colonial peoples, and then these empires, not just the British, but the Spanish and the French, who have been in North America since the 17th century as well. And so if you do alter the perspective a little bit, the Revolution looks less and less like a war of colonial independence, 13 colonies asserting their independence, and more and more like a civil war in a lot of ways. And oftentimes the Revolution gets described that way. If you look at the southern theater of the war, which is where the fighting really takes place after 1778. After the French enter the war in 1778, the British have to kind of redeploy their resources because they're worried about protecting colonies they have in the Caribbean. They're worried protecting Britain from an invasion from France, you know, which would be a possibility now that they're at war with France.
Oh, sure.
And so in the South, the war becomes a real conflict between patriots and loyalists.
Okay.
And you see a lot of loyalist militias that are being commanded by British officers but are made up of colonial Americans.
Oh, how
many of them recent immigrants from the Scottish Highlands, for example,
okay.
who are still feeling a loyalty to the British crown, fighting the American revolutionaries. And that war is a partisan style warfare, small bands, heavily armed, oftentimes pillage and plunder of, you know, the plantations or homesteads. Native Americans get wrapped up in that as well, Cherokee Indians, Creek Indians, who are generally more inclined to ally with the British than they are with the Americans.
Why was that?
They're inclined to ally with the British because the British are their primary suppliers in the fur trade.
Okay.
By this point, 1770s, 1780s, Indians along the Appalachian frontier are still autonomous in terms of their politics and their territory, but they've become economically dependent upon the fur trade.
Oh, could you just say a little bit more
about
that?
Because
I always think about the French, actually, when you say the fur trade.
Yeah, well, I think the typical image of the fur trade is trapping beaver,
yeah.
and hunting beaver pelts, exporting them from the Great Lakes region
yeah, right.
and Canada and so forth. But there's a very large deerskin trade.
Really?
Yes, in the southern colonies.
That.
I mean, a massive number of deerskins are being shot and processed by Cherokee, Creek hunters, Choctaw Indians, and then they're being exported through either Virginia or Charleston, South Carolina, to Britain. Deerskins are the plastics of the late 18th century in Europe. They are being used for all sorts of things, as belts and machinery, for clothing, for bookbinding, and things like that.
What were the Native Americans receiving in return?
They're receiving textiles, primarily woven cloth from Britain, but also metalwares of various types, kettles. You see Native American production of Native pottery just plummets when they
really?
Get fur trade. Yeah, when you think about it, how hard it is to make a pot, and how heavy they are, and how fragile they are.
Fragile, that's what I was going to say.
If you replace that with a copper or brass kettle, which is much lighter, which is in some ways more durable, and then when it when it rusts or whatever, can be repurposed for all sorts of things like arrowheads and so forth. And then of course alcohol, is a major part of this. Rum from the British, brandy from the French, and so the Spanish at this time are in Florida, along the Gulf Coast of Florida. The French are in Louisiana. They've established trading posts in modern-day Alabama, Mobile, New Orleans. They are in the lower Mississippi Valley, what they called at the time the Illinois country, a little further north. And so there's a very intensive competition between the British, the French, and the Spanish for Indian trade and Indian alliance in the southeast. And so that is being upset by the American War of Independence.
So the colonists, however, weren't involved in any of this trade.
Sure, there are colonists who are involved in it, although not not as heavily as these foreign
nations,
powers. There are certainly colonists who engage in the fur trade, but one of the distinctive things about the population of British North America is how rapidly its population was growing in the 18th century. Most of these colonies that were established by the French, the Dutch, the British, the Spanish in the Americas, European populations took a very long time for them to achieve a positive rate of natural reproduction because of the disease climate in the Caribbean, for example, because of the labor systems, indentured servitude, which tend to be very harsh. People are malnourished, they're worked very hard. But in British North America, where there's a more temperate climate, certainly as African slave labor replaces indentured white labor in places like Virginia and the Carolinas, the white population is healthier, it reproduces more quickly. Benjamin Franklin estimates in 1751 that there are 1 million British colonists in North America, and that they are doubling every 25 years. And historical demographers have validated that.
Really?
So he's pretty much right on the mark. And so it's rapidly growing. And, of course, migration is bringing more and more Europeans over. So so those colonists in the South are primarily working in agriculture, right? They're they're growing tobacco, they're growing rice for export on these world markets, or they're subsistence farmers, who are out there on the frontier, the backcountry of the Carolinas and so forth. Some of them are involved in the fur trade, but but not as many.
Okay.
And then if you go a little further north along kind of the Great Lakes frontier, what they refer to as the Ohio country, which today we'd call Western Pennsylvania in eastern Ohio, that is another region where the fur trade has been very extensive. The Native Americans are very dependent on trade with British suppliers, so they're inclined to ally with the British. But American settlers are also beginning to spill over the Appalachian Mountains into places like Pittsburgh, which was initially Fort Pitt, established by the Brits in 1759 or so. And then And Indians there are fighting to retain control of their lands because there's this heavy influx of these settlers. And the Americans are going to consider this conconquered territory. In 1783, the Peace of Paris ends the American Revolution, and Great Britain cedes its claims to the land between the Appalachian Mountains and the Mississippi River to the United States. This is a tremendous victory, diplomatic
victory. How far south from
that? All the way down, Georgia to the Mississippi River.
Okay.
Yeah, that's territory that the Brits have claimed since 1763, since they, were victorious in the French and Indian War.
Okay,
and that is territory that the British, during the 1760s and 1770s, were trying to keep as Indian territory. You know, the British famously in 1763 issued the Proclamation of 1763, which prohibited settlement west of the Appalachian Mountains. And that was, you know, ultimately that the idea was ultimately that land would be turned into colonies. But in order to keep the peace with the Indians, who had been allied with the French, in order to ensure the success of the fur trade, the British were going to keep settlers out of that territory. 1783, 20 years later, the Brits cede that territory to the victorious Americans. And, of course, the Americans consider that conquered territory.
Yeah, sure.
They do not recognize any Indian title to that land.
Okay.
They are going to settle that land very quickly, as we know, the states of Kentucky and Tennessee and, of course, Mississippi, Alabama, Ohio are going to be formed out of this territory. And so Indians have been feeling that land pressure. They have fought very much with the American patriots to defend their claims to that land. Perhaps the most brutal episode, I think, in the Revolution occurs very late in the war, in 1782. We, as school children, we learned that the American Revolution ends for all intents and purposes with the British surrender at Yorktown in 1781. But in fact, the war doesn't officially end until another 2 years with the signing of the peace treaty. So what's going on for those 2 years?
Yeah.
A lot of this frontier conflict is going on, not between redcoats and patriots, but between patriots and Indians.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
And so in a small little missionary town in eastern Ohio called Natinhutin, which is a Moravian mission town been established among the Delaware Indians, a patriot militia out of Pittsburgh systematically murders 98 Indians. Yes, in I believe it's March of 1782. They suspect these Indians, who are pacifists, they're Christian converts, you know, who have been converted by Moravians, who are a pacifist.
Yeah, right,
sect.
Absolutely.
But the patriots suspect them of using that pacifism as a shield to actually aid and abet the British, who are at Fort Detroit, modern-day Detroit. And so this patriot militia goes up there, under no authority of the Continental Army. It's not like George Washington issues orders, but this militia goes out there to the frontier and systematically murders 98 men, women, and children. And it's not something we hear about, certainly.
It's not something that we
are going to be proud of. It's not something we're going to celebrate when we talk about the 4th of July. But in fact, it's a type of violence that is going on the frontier as a result of independence, as the Americans want to claim that territory. There's going to be another war, what's often referred to as the Ohio War or the Ohio Indian War, between 1791 and 1795, as settlers from primarily the Northeast, New England, Pennsylvania, New York, come into modern-day Ohio, and Indians there, Shawnee Indians primarily, Miami Indians, resist that intrusion. And, you know, there's a very nasty level of conflict during the 1790s there. A lot of settlers taken captive, some of them killed and attacked in their homesteads, but also, obviously, the Americans retaliating in kind.
Yeah.
In the South, that's also going to happen. You know, Daniel Boone leading his settlers into Kentucky during this period are going to be fighting with Indians south of the Ohio River as well. It's a contest that is not really resolved until the War of 1812.
Yeah.
And in fact, if you look at the American Revolution from a Native American perspective, let's say you were an Indian child born in the Ohio region in 1750. You know, this is one long period of warfare from the French and Indian War to the American Revolution to the Ohio Indian War to the War of 1812 that you're growing up in, that you're trying to maintain control of your territory. You're trying to feed your family.
Yeah.
And if you're male, you're fighting, you know, periodically against these forces.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, it, from a Native perspective, the American Revolution certainly is not something to be very, very happy about. It's going to set in motion this prolonged period of warfare.
Did when the Founding Fathers were writing and talking about this vision that they had, right, of this new land, did Native Americans figure into that? I mean, did what did they
What did they think would be the nature of this relationship?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. And as you might suspect, there was a range of responses among the founding generation about that. There were some founding fathers who had close experience with Native Americans and had a lot of respect for them.
Okay.
George Washington had, during the start of his career during the French and Indian War, had Indians as scouts, as mm-hmm. auxiliaries with troops that he was leading in the Ohio country. He had a healthy respect for the martial abilities of Native Americans. But he would also, in most of the Indians he encountered during that period were allied with the French, and so, he considered these Indians as enemies as well. But he had respect for them.
Okay.
And he, as president during the 1790s, he wanted to deal with them peacefully. He knew war was not a very effective way to deal with Native Americans because it was going to be very expensive.
Yeah.
The American federal government did not have the resources to be constantly engaged in warfare with Native Americans on the frontier. And so he established a policy as our first president, which emphasized diplomacy and negotiation, but always with the expectation that Indians would cede territory to the Americans because of debt from the fur trade, because demographically, they could not resist this kind of rising tide of European settlement in their territories. Another founding father with a great deal of respect for Indians was Thomas Jefferson. He didn't really have the same deal of personal experience with natives that George Washington did. But if you look at the things he wrote about Indians during the 1780s, or even his conduct when he was president in the first decade of the 19th century, he considers Indians potential equals with Europeans. He describes them as savages, but he says they are to us what the native indigenous Britons were to the ancient Romans when the ancient Romans invaded Britain. They are tribal, they are illiterate, but they have a germ of genius in them, for self-government. Again, he admires Indians for their bravery, for their kind of natural equality that they have with each other, and so forth. But as president, he also wants to, he's the president who engineers the Louisiana Purchase. He wants to see an expansion of the American population into this Indian territory. And he encourages federal agents, for example, to who are working in federal forts in the Western Territory, to encourage Indians to go into debt in the fur trade. Because he says only by going into debt will they be willing to part with their lands. And so this will be one of the ways in which we will get them to cede their land peacefully. But when you look at what Jefferson writes about Africans and African Americans, it's, strikes us today as extremely racist, that he, he says that if the day comes when there's emancipation in the United States, the freed slaves will have to leave. They'll have to go back to Africa or be colonized in Central America or be sent somewhere. Jefferson's famous phrase is beyond the reach of mixture. He does not see a future.
I've never heard that.
He does not see a future in which black and white live peacefully in the United States. But when he's talking to Cherokee chiefs as president, he says, one day your blood will mix with ours and together we'll overspread this continent.
Very interesting.
Yeah, and he speaks in a way about, obviously sexual union and reproduction between Indians and whites that, he thinks is going to be just fine when he fears that among the African.
Even as he.
even as what
he doesn't
we know
really
about.
Fear it.
He's a very tortured soul, I think, in that regard.
Exactly.
His reputation has suffered because of this.
Yeah.
So those are founding fathers who exhibit a respect for Native Americans, clearly want to deal with them diplomatically rather than militarily. What they are up against, though, are these frontier settlers who are much more inclined to resort to violence when they deal with Indians, who are not particularly good at distinguishing between Indians who have signed treaties with the United States and are allies versus Indians who are openly hostile and trying to resist the expansion of the United States. And so you got this pattern of violence between vigilante groups, you know, militias against Native Americans. And in fact, you know, somebody like George Washington is president. One of the reasons he wants a strong military is he wants to be able to police that interaction. He thinks that's it's going to be necessary. You know, the as we move into the 19th century, and, you know, Andrew Jackson famously in the policy of Indian removal, you know, that is a you can debate to what degree did the founding fathers anticipate Jackson's policy of Indian removal, right? Because there are some intimations that, you know, as early as the 1790s or the first decade of the 19th century, that people in charge of the federal government are thinking about Indian removal. That it's going to be necessary to just push Indians them. Farther and farther west. But I think people like Washington and Jefferson did see the potential to live with Indians, among Indians, in a way that would not require this removal. You know, Jefferson's Indian policy is often referred to as the civilization policy. The idea was that Indians would be able to retain their lands, but they would be confined to smaller and smaller tracts of land as they ceded more territory to the United States, and they would have to convert from being hunters and gatherers to being farmers. Now, these Indians already farmed, but what he's talking about is commercial farmers, that they are going to change from subsistence farming of corn and kind of a mixed economy of hunting and farming and so forth to entering the commercial marketplace like other American farmers. Most famously, the five civilized tribes of the Southeast, the Cherokee, the Creek, the Choctaw, the Chickasaw, and the Seminole, are the Indians who adopt that policy and become civilized, as, you know, Jefferson would have defined it. And many of them convert to Christianity. They intermarry with white families and settlers. They adopt African slaveholding. The wealthiest members of the Cherokee Nation are, in essence, Southern planters, who own slaves, who grow cotton, and so forth. And so they are often held up, you know, in Jefferson's era as the model of the future of these Native Americans.
So that all took place in the 18th century.
It takes place starting in the 1790s.
Okay.
And then in the first two or three decades of the 19th century. And then Jackson says no. You know, that they must leave.
Oh, really? Okay, so that that did not protect them.
No, it did not. And in fact, you know, that's the one of the cruel ironies of this is that those Indians who exhibited the greatest success in adopting the civilization policy were the ones who suffered the most from the removal era, because they lost the most in terms of property. They lost the most in terms of population. It was a very brutal period in American relations with the American government's relations with Native Americans.
Yeah. Well, this has all been very interesting and I think good for us to think of. I just want to end with a question about, and I don't know whether how this would relate to the work that you do. I mean, as you think of here in the 21st century, right, it feels to me, I think probably to many people, that we are still in the encounters between Americans of European descent and Native Americans, that continues to be a pretty exploitative, unhealthy kind of relationship. I mean, do you take lessons from what you do and think about that today, or do you feel like there's been a healthy shift, or how do you...
Well, you can look at that question in a number of ways. If you're a Native American today, certainly you feel, that you are still receiving the raw end of the deal, the short end of the stick. But Native American peoples have been remarkably resilient, and their population reached a nadir in right around 1900.
Okay.
In the 20th century, and certainly the start of the 21st century, has been a story of recovery in a lot of ways. Population recovery.
Population-wise.
You know, at their nadir in 1900, the federal census, I think, counted 250,000 Native Americans, right? A quarter
it's
of
shocking.
A million.
Yeah.
I think in the most recent census, it was about 2.5 million.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So population recovery. Among some Native peoples, there has been also... economic recovery when we talk about casinos and gaming and so forth. Certainly federal policy since about 1980 has done a lot for Native Americans in terms of recognizing them as legitimate peoples within the United States. Things like the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, which says we're not going to put your remains on displays in museums, we're going to repatriate to Native people's sacred artifacts. The Native American Gaming Act, which allowed the possibility to create these businesses that have been lucrative for some, some Native American peoples. I think a lot of non-Native Americans look at that today and say, well, they're not real Indians if they're engaged in gaming, or they're not real Indians because if you look at them, there's clear evidence of intermarriage with Europeans or African Americans and so forth. And I think if you study the long haul of Native American history, you can counter that pretty quickly by saying, oh, no, they're Indians, all right. That has been a strategy that Native Americans have used from the very beginning to survive of intermarriage. They are less than 50% of the current Native American population in the United States still lives on Indian reservations.
Really?
Yeah. So they have adapted, they have assimilated into American society. Many of them live in cities. You could have people who identify themselves as Native American living on a suburban street somewhere. And that's, they have assimilated into American society, yet have retained Native American identity in all sorts of ways. And again, in the same way that you might identify with your heritage in a way different from mine, maybe for me it's cooking, maybe for you it's song, these are, a lot of these are people who still, they might be working a suburban job, but who still consider themselves Native American. And to me, that is a story of survival and persistence and resilience. And I think that's something to be celebrated, not condemned or dismissed as being ersatz.
Right.
Now, in the treaty, for those Indians who still do live on reservations, I think a negative perception of that is, they're dependent on federal welfare. The worst thing that ever happened to them was the reservations. Mm-hmm. They should be made to go out and survive without the education benefits and the other benefits that they receive by virtue of being on reservations. I'd say, if you look at the history, those reservations exist because treaties were signed with the federal government by those Native people, some of them going all the way back to the 1790s in George Washington's first administration.
Wow.
And those treaties should be honored in the same way that we honor treaties. Over the long haul, the federal government has done a pretty bad job of honoring those treaties.
Yeah.
And if finally
that's certainly true,
in the last 50 years, it's gotten better at it, then I think power to the Indian peoples who have been able to call the federal government to task to do that.
That's very interesting. I think that's a helpful way to think about it and interpret that.
So for me, it's a story of persistence, oftentimes, against enormous odds, and a story of adaptation, that the Indians who are living in the United States today are not the same people who were living there in 1890 or 1830 or 1770, right? They have grown and changed and adopted and adapted in the same way the rest of us have to living in the modern world.
Well, thank you very much. Again, Tim, it was wonderful talking with you, and this was, a perfect podcast for July 4th. So, again, my guest was Dr. Tim Shannon, Professor of History, Chair of the History Department at Gettysburg College, and thank you very much for your conversation.
You're very welcome.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from Historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.com. .edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.